want to start by saying this is Pamela Grundy, and I'm here interviewing Coach Kay Yao in her office at North Carolina State University. It's the 22nd of June, 2005, and this is for the Women's Leadership Series. And my first question would be, just starting with basketball, what is your first memory of basketball?
My first memory of basketball is when I was 7 years old, and at Christmas, I got my very own basketball. That Christmas, a goal was put up in my backyard, and it was to stay there for many, many years. It would actually still be there now, but we are renovating my dad's and mom's home place, and so we took the goal down, but soon it will be replaced, and we're actually laying a full-size court in our backyard. And so that's my first memory, getting that basketball, having the goal put up, and from that moment just starting to really entertain myself for hours, really, just trying to put the basketball in the hoop.
Now, how did a seven-year-old girl come to get a basketball and hoop for a Christmas present? What was that?
Well, I guess my mom and dad both played basketball. My mom played in high school. They both played on mill teams. They both worked in hosiery mills in Burlington. And as a result of their love for basketball and sport, it probably didn't hurt them in getting that job, because, you know, I have a picture actually of my mom somewhere around here in my office on her mill team.
Oh, okay.
And so they played basketball as they worked. Okay. It's sort of like an AAU league. So their love for basketball is the reason I'm sure that I got my first basketball. However, there was never any pressure for me to actually use it or work at any kind of skills. It was just for fun and something they enjoyed, so I'm sure they thought I might enjoy it as well.
So you hadn't asked for the basketball or been wanting it?
No, I don't remember asking for it. I think I was wanting a bicycle, and you know, I also got that, and a number of other things. Actually, it was my last Christmas as the only child. So I guess they really flooded me on that Christmas, because after that, another child, another and another. And, you know, we became a larger family, and I learned how to be a good team member.
And how many brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters and one brother.
Okay. And did they all play basketball also?
They all play basketball. Okay. My brother went to Clemson on a football scholarship, but he played on the varsity high school basketball team. Okay. And both of my sisters played basketball. And as a matter of fact, they retired the number 14 at Gibsonville High School after my youngest sister finished playing there. And that was the number I had also worn.
Okay. So you were well known as the sisters.
The Yao sisters, I think, from Gibsonville, are known as sort of like the Holt brothers, who both came and played football here at NC State, and both are professional players. They're from Gibsonville, and I think, you know, people are around that town know the Holt brothers, and the Yao sisters are all in basketball.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting. What was Gibsonville like at the time that you were growing up?
It's a great small town where the community and the town was completely involved in what was going on at the high school. I mean, very supportive, you know, strong PTA, strong boosters club for athletics. Just the town came out and just supported the students as well as the student athletes at Gibsonville High School. And you couldn't hardly go anywhere in Gibsonville, do anything. You seemed that it was truly a village raising all the kids, because many other adults would tell you what to do and what not to do, and they would also tell your parents. And at that time, you just didn't question answers. You just answered the questions. And parents were very supportive of people in authority, of coaches and teachers. I mean, I always knew I was never going to be right. If the teacher said something or the coach said something, that's the way that it was. And it was up to me to make the adjustments and to make the changes necessary to fit into whatever it was that they were requesting. And no matter, it might could have had a sound, you know, argument on my side, but my parents were just supportive of authority. And, you know, I think it helped me greatly.
Did you have any coaches or teachers that you particularly looked up to?
Well, I have to say my freshman coach was a woman named Peggy Gunn. She is, of course, married now, and she lives in Greensboro. I see her not often, but every once in a while our paths cross. And she was my freshman coach. And I guess she stands out in a way because she sort of got me started at that level. And when I was in junior high, there was a lady, Irma Dantzler, and she taught physical education, and she very much encouraged me, and I kept score for the varsity team. So I was really into watching them, and I looked up to a lot of players on the high school team when I was in junior high school. Okay. And those players also motivated me in basketball. Mm-hmm. But the teachers, there are three teachers that really influenced me in high school. One was a math teacher, Ted Bowen, mm-hmm. and I had two English teachers, Vivian Davis and Mrs. J. Allen Hunter. Mm-hmm. Okay, and Mrs. Hunter had actually taught at Elon and had retired and then came back and taught me senior English and was, she was sponsor of the editor, sponsor of the annual, okay, of which I was the editor. And so I had a lot of interaction with her in English class and then in extracurricular activities. And these two women, they were very different. Mrs. Hunter was older. She was very understanding. She also taught me French. And, I mean, she was just great. She had a lot of patience. But they all had high expectations and all demanded excellence. But she had this kind of patience and understanding and just help. Where Mrs. Davis, you knew you had better be prepared in her class. I mean, you had to have your homework done, and you knew she knew her subject matter, and she would call on you in an instant, and wow, you would really feel badly if you couldn't even begin to give an answer, because she was teaching, and they were all expected you to learn and to do your part. And Mr. Bowen in math, he made math fun. He actually came to NC State, got his degree here, and when it snowed, we might go up on the roof and look at the formations of snowflakes. I mean, we would do some very interesting things like that, but he made me enjoy math, and he was fun teacher. He had a great sense of humor, and he just was a great teacher. He knew his math. And so these are three people that really encouraged me greatly. And I happen to have been president of my junior and my senior class. And so I was strong in the running for a valedictorian, but just by hundreds of a point, I became salutatorian, you know. And I sort of know what it is, really strive for something and then just come up maybe just a little short. But I had given the best that I had within me to be the best that I could become. And so you always feel good just knowing you gave your best. It may be disappointed for a moment, but that's short term. Long term, you have nothing to look back and say, if I had done this or if I had done that. I was given my best. And so they were always encouragers to me, whether it was making decisions as president of the class or the annual, being editor of the annual, or doing my homework or anything that I might be going through. They were great, all great encouragers, and I would say great listeners. And I really appreciated them.
Well, that's terrific. You mentioned a little bit earlier that you said that, that having to deal with authority and your parents' unquestioned support of that authority had been good for you. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Just the fact that my parents backed authority gave me a great respect for authority. Mm-hmm. I knew that there were people in charge. They were in control. They had to make decisions. And all decisions they made weren't going to be ones that I always liked. And that when they set expectations and they told me those expectations, that I was to try to live up to those expectations. And even if I thought that expectation was wrong or should be something else, they were in authority and they had expressed it, and that's what I was to try to do. Mm-hmm. And my parents always supported authority mm-hmm. in that way. I mean, I never had the feeling exactly like you're not on my side. You're just almost, they tried to explain to me, you know, what expectations were. Mm-hmm. And when people laid them out and their rules and regulations and guidelines, that's what you do. There is a process to change those things. Mm-hmm. But not to do them is not the process.
Right.
Or to do something else and do it a different way without changing the guidelines or the policies or the rules is not the way to go about it. Mm-hmm. And I think my mom was especially great encourager, had a very positive outlook. Her attitude was unbelievable, and she always magnified the good things and the blessings and rather than the disappointments or the hard times. And that's what she taught all her children to do. And I know if I ever complain, my mom would even listen to my really, you know, I mean, she would let me say what I would say, but then she might remind me that, you know, Kay, the man without shoes felt bad until he met the man without feet. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people that are dealing with things tougher than that, mm-hmm. you know, so you have to get it in perspective, you know, because you can't, sometimes we can be acting as if it's the worst thing in the world, and we need somebody to give us a perspective and a balance and to show us what we have to be grateful for while we're just focusing on our disappointments and our hard times. And she always said, in every dark cloud, there is a silver lining. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate all the things that she would say to me. And if you don't have something good to say about somebody, then don't say anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're just, it's hurtful, it tears people down, and the idea is to build people up. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you just shouldn't be negative in that way about people. And she's just told me lots of things. I mean, what about people that I might not could get along with or just maybe didn't like as much as others. She always told me to pray for those people. And she said, if you pray for them consistently, there is no way that you will continue to feel a dislike for them. Mm-hmm. And she was right.
Mm-hmm. That's terrific to have somebody behind you that way and really doing that. Did most of the people in Gibsonville work at the mills? Is that what people did, or did people in Gibsonville do?
Yeah, I would say that many of the people in Gibsonville worked in mills. We had hosiery mills there, textile mills, and also they were farmers. A lot of them raised large crops of tobacco. When I was a kid, a number of summers I spent making money putting in tobacco. So I know I was a hander, and I worked early in the morning till really dark at night. We were hanging in the barns the tobacco, you know, that we had tied up that day. So it was another experience just to understand what it's like to really have a job and to really work. It was really long hours, and you know, you had to just keep working. You couldn't just take a break because it was moving all day. Your breaks really came at meal times. Mm-hmm. And so I'd say a lot of farming and a lot of mill work.
Okay. Had many members of your family gone to college?
My mom and dad didn't go to college, but my brother went to college. He did not complete his degree. Myself and my other two sisters went to college. I got a master's degree. My middle sister got a master's and then a doctorate, and then my youngest sister has worked on her master's partially,
right.
And is still in that process.
So your parents hadn't gone to college, but did you think that was that your goal from a young age to go to college?
Well, my parents, it's just something that my parents wanted was something for their children that they hadn't had the opportunity to do. Mm-hmm. There is no way that either one of them could have gone to college. Mm-hmm. They came from fairly large families, 7 children each, and they, you know, came through the Depression, and it just was no way for them that they could, and they wanted this for their children. And I was greatly influenced by the three teachers that I had in high school, and since 2 were English and 1 was math, I really wanted to go to college to be an English teacher. And I have to attribute that specific part to those teachers that I had, because I was, you know, I loved English, and it was basically because of these teachers. And so I just had a goal, you know. I guess I just started thinking about it really when I was in high school, and I was influenced in that direction by my teachers, and my parents just, you know, always wanted that for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm the oldest child in my family, and so I always wanted to please my parents. And so that was something I really wanted to do and just felt that I should do, because they had always said that I should do it.
Let's get back to basketball for a minute. In Gibsonville, they've obviously the high schools and I guess the junior highs have a boys' team and a girls' team. Was there a difference in how those two teams were viewed?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I went to Gibsonville High School, which was a Guilford County high school. Mm-hmm. Just 6 miles away was Burlington. And at Walter Williams High School in Burlington, that was a city school. There were no teams for girls at Walter Williams High School. But 6 miles away in a county school, in Alamance, where Burlington is, they had county schools, and they had teams, but not the city schools. But it's just interesting because if I had just lived 6 miles away within the city, I would not have had the opportunity to play. But because I went to Gibsonville High School, a county school, I had that opportunity. And the gym was packed for both the boys and the girls game. I mean, at that time, you played the girls varsity and the boys varsity all games together. And then the JVs played their games together. And so, I mean, it was packed for both. That's just supported the community, and the town supported both teams. And I just felt we had a great opportunity. And high school would not have been anything like high school to me if I hadn't been playing basketball. Mm-hmm. It just added something to that total experience that was unbelievable. And if I hadn't had it, I would have personally missed so much for me. Mm-hmm. But there weren't college teams, so I was never thinking about really to college. I knew, I just accepted it didn't exist. I didn't expect it. I mean, that's the way that was. So when I was in college, I always felt like something was missing. And it wasn't until after I graduated from college, I got a job, and I started coaching, that I realized it had been sport. That's what it had been all along. That's what I was missing. And I didn't really understand that when I was in college.
What did you like about basketball? Why did you like it so much?
I think I like basketball. That just happened to be my sport.
Right.
It could have been another sport, but I think it was just the challenge that sport brings. I just thrive on the challenge of it. Working to become the best that you can become, to develop whatever talents you have to your potential, and then to go out and test them against someone else. I mean, it's just a challenge, and it's just fun. And I guess I just have a love for competition. And I feel it's a love in the right direction, because I think competing with people rather than against people, it's just a mindset. It's how you arrange your mind, really, about competition. Because I don't think that you can perform as well when you go out with a mindset, I'm going to compete against these people. It's nothing, you know, against anybody that you're competing with, but that's what you're doing, competing with them. Mm-hmm. And you just give the best that you have, and they give the best they have. And if at the end, you've even gotten a little bit better because of that experience in itself. And you know there can be only one winner on the scoreboard, but there could be all winners as people. I mean, and I realized this early on, that if you give the best that you have, that when it's all said and done, you may have a disappointment on the scoreboard, but there are other ways to win.
Right.
And just trying and giving your best is the greatest way to win, because you may be disappointed, but really, if you did give your best and you played really well, after a period of time, you feel good long-term that you did that. It was sort of like striving to be valedictorian. It's the same type of thing. It's just in the end, you want to be able to, as people say, look yourself in the mirror and just know that you've given your best. And it's just exciting. It's a game. It doesn't really count in the course of life in a lot of ways. I mean, it's not like a life and death situation. But sometimes it can seem like it a little. But it's almost like in some parts of sport are practice for real life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're working and on developing certain qualities and characteristics that can help you succeed in life and no matter what you do. And you learn about discipline. If you really want to compete and be good, you have to learn about discipline. And you understand commitment to excellence. I mean, and sacrifice and dedication and just like hard work. And the important part that enthusiasm plays in success, you start to learn about all the ability to work with people, mm-hmm. being a great team person, mm-hmm. and also, you know, being a leader. I mean, you just learn so much in sport. And in physical education, when I got my master's, I did my master's rather than doing it in English. I did it in physical education, and I also got an undergraduate certification in physical education while I was there. Just went on a 2-year program to get it across the board. And when I was getting those degrees, they said, like, you know, these qualities and characteristics, they're not just caught, uh-huh. but they have to be taught. Mm-hmm. But if you have a great leader, you know, there'll be teachable moments, mm-hmm. many of them. Because sport involves the emotions so much. It involves every part of a person. Mm-hmm. I mean, in English, you know, you just didn't always see the total person involved in the classroom. Yeah. But on the court, every part of us is involved. Mm-hmm. And it all plays a part in the end,
right.
for the results.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I think that's really interesting and really gets to the subject, what we're talking about, which is leadership. And I guess you went to college and then you came out and got a job teaching and coaching. Is that right?
Yes.
And I guess that's when you started to then be the role model for the girls that you were coaching. And I'm curious what you went about trying to teach them, especially early on when you were just starting to be a coach. What were your goals for your
Well, I think when I first started out coaching, I didn't really have a mentor, you know? And I think this is one of the things that I missed because there were very few women coaches. And actually, you know, I really didn't know one personally. And so, and then I hadn't been trained to be a coach. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of on my own, except the men's coach, he had at Allen J. High School, where my first job was, he had coached women and men for 13 years.
Okay.
And it had championship teams, so it was great. And so he said he would help me to learn how to draw up practices, and actually he'd sit on the bench with me during games until I felt more comfortable. You know, so he was very willing to help me. So he was a person who helped me, and he was very, very fundamental coach. I consider he was a very excellent coach. Mm-hmm. So this was a person who started helping me. Mm-hmm. But after a while in the practices, you know, I started being able to do the practices, and he felt, you know, I could just sort of be on my own for the games more. You know, he helped whenever I asked questions, but he had his own team and his own program, you know. And so I attended clinics. I read books. I looked at films, I mean, about basketball. I learned I sort of on my own. Mm-hmm. You know, I just had to go out there and ask the questions and just try to learn. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And I think that today, women going into coaching, you know, they have a greater opportunity because they have many people who could be role models now. And many of them actually played at the college, you know, high school, college level, AAU. They've run through a number of coaches. And so they were very fortunate. And, you know, somebody like Sue Gunter, who played AAU. Right. I didn't even know about AAU. Mm-hmm. You know, I lived in North Carolina, small town, and I didn't know these things existed except for after my senior year of high school basketball, I was asked to play for what was termed a semi-pro team for Payne Oil Company. Mm-hmm. And I played for just that season after my senior year. But when I went to college, then I wasn't here to play. Mm-hmm. And so I just got a little taste, but I still didn't know that there was like Wayland Baptist or Nashville Business. I didn't know that. It just, nobody ever told me about it. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn a lot on my own. So it is really great that today there are a lot more role models and a lot more help for people getting started. And so just start at a higher level, just like players start at a higher level today, so we can, you know, overall reach greater heights because of that. But I can't really remember when I first started coaching. I think my concentration as far as teaching qualities and characteristics would have been along the lines of my mom, really, about staying positive, about maintaining our confidence, about working really hard, and about being good team members. I mean, those things I had always known about in, you know, in other situations. And I could see how, wow, it was magnified in sport. You know, if we're going to do this, we got to get on the same wavelength, and we got to come together as one. And in order to be at our best. and there's no way we can have one person go in this direction, another this direction, another, and expect to accomplish a task with excellence. So I think that's where I would have been at that time.
And, I mean, you were really a pioneer in terms of being, as you say, a female coach. Did you think of yourself as that way? Did you have the sense that you were doing something that women really hadn't done before?
I guess I never thought of myself as a pioneer. I think I was just trying to survive, trying to get better. I'm big on, you know, even today, with people not just getting by, but getting better. And I was just trying to improve, because it's through improvement that one has a chance for success and a team has a chance to win. I mean, you'll have to continually improve. And I was just always focused on learning. I know learning is a lifetime process. And, I mean, I've been coaching basketball 40 years, and I still have much to learn. Look at the tapes, all those our new DVDs that, you know, I will be watching. Yeah. And so it's nothing within me that ever thinks I have arrived or that I know. I know that there's more and more to learn. Mm-hmm. And every little thing that you learn, knowledge is power, and it can really help take you to higher levels. And I can help take my individual players and our team to higher levels the more that I learn. And so learning is just a lifetime process.
Over these 40 years of coaching and learning, how would you describe the leadership style that you've developed?
Well, my, I guess, sort of philosophy on leadership, I do, leadership is influence. And even greater, I think, is an inspiring influence, is the way that you want leadership to be. And I'd have to say my leadership is really probably based a lot on the word love. I have a strong faith. And in the Bible, in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, there's a chapter that describes love, that the entire chapter. And it has a section where it starts saying love is kind, love is patient, you know, love is self-control. It just, and when you get through that, if you think of what they're talking about, what God is talking about, love to be, a leader, you can put, a leader is kind. A leader is patient. You know, a leader is self-control. A leader is all, is honest, truthful. I mean, a leader is all of these things. And I really feel that if leadership is based on love, that really in love and service, this is my idea. And there's nothing within me that thinks of a leader as being a boss or, you know, just having power through position. Mm-hmm. Like I telling people what to do just because you have the position. I just think of it more as you do have an authority, but not, you don't want it because of position. You want it because people respect you and they see that you do what you say. You are a role model. I do not see how you cannot be a role model, because you cannot say, you whatever you ask people to do, I think if you do what you say, you know, you can't tell people, just do what I say, not what I do. You cannot say that to people, you know. At least you can say it, but I do not think you'll have the respect. You gain great respect by integrity and by honesty and by vulnerability. I mean, being real. And people, if you're asking people to do it, then you need to do it yourself. And that way you have people, when people see that, they will follow you. You know, character. First of all, let me just say this. There's a book by Jeff Jansen, and sort of like a sports psychologist, and I really believe this part of his where you can't lead anybody else until you can lead yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, and leading yourself is about character. You have to have kind of character, and that's the things I'm talking about now with the based leadership based on love and service. You have to have character, honesty, mm-hmm. and integrity. I mean, and then you have to be composed yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to have a cool head in a hot situation. You have to show composure in crisis situations. Mm-hmm. You have to have commitment yourself. Mm-hmm. How can you ask somebody else to be committed and to excellence and you're not yourself? Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to see that. And you have to have confidence. Mm-hmm. You can't lose confidence in yourself. You know, you have to speak with confidence and know what you're about. And once you get your own house in order in these areas, then I think that you now are a person who can begin to qualify to have people who might want to follow you. Without getting your house in order, you're going to be a weak leader, I think. But a strong leader gets their house in order in these areas, and then they now want to serve other people, want to help other people become all that they want to become and all that they can become. You want to help them to reach their goals. And I found that if you help enough other people reach the goals that they want to reach, mm-hmm. you'll find out that you reach all your goals and above and beyond just because you are serving the people around you in that way, whether it's your staff or whether it's players, whoever it is, you're just helping them to reach their goals, then you'll reach yours, and you don't have, you know, to worry about that. But I just see leadership as serving people, and it's an inspiring influence. Mm-hmm. And I see love as the bottom, the core of it for myself. And I just have to love people mm-hmm. and really, truly have a desire to help them. Mm-hmm.
Does this go back to your mother at all when you think about how you developed this or how you came to have this work?
Yes, I think my mother was a role model for sure. I think she's a person that I definitely would follow because I know that she had my own best interest at heart. And I think that that's what people have to know about you as a leader. I mean, when you know somebody has your own best interest at heart, even when some tough decisions are made, some that you don't agree with and you don't like, you are still willing to go along with it in the end because you believe in that person. I mean, you do know that they care about you. There's a saying that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care about them. Mm-hmm. And when they know how much you care about them, they want to know everything, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, you want people to know, but it has to be genuine. It can't be fake, right. You know. And that's why being real and just, people know the difference, mm-hmm. you know, between real and fake. And when it is genuine and people know it, and you have that kind of spirit, people want to follow you. I mean, and I'm saying all that based on you have to have an expertise in the field. But, you know, even if you didn't have as much of an expertise, but people knew you really cared about them, and it's amazing, I think you'd still be able to. It's much better than having all this expertise and then really in a way what some people would call human skills, not having the human skills, the technical knowledge, but no human skills. You have to have the balance between the two.
Do you think there's anything distinctly female about your leadership style or your philosophy? Do you have any?
You know, I know that I think that many people would think that it is because I can think that people would, there would be many men who would say, you can't be this way or that way. You have to be, you know, stern. You have to be But tough love is being firm. You know, it's not like you just have a love, do what you want. We're not talking about that. We're talking about developing responsible people that are accountable. People who don't settle for just being good. As John F. Kennedy said, the greatest enemy of excellence is good. There are people who good is good enough, so they don't want any more. You know, that's fine. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a tough love, and that you're demanding it, you know. But you know what? You're not in it for yourself. You're in it for the right reasons, to serve and to help other people to become all that they can become. And you see them for who they can become, and not for who they are right now, where they are right now. You see them for who they can be and who they can become if you just stick with them. Because discipline is all about making people do what they don't want to do so that they can become who they want to become. And you, as a leader, know this. So, you know, I'm talking about a tough love. But, no, to me, no, it's not about woman. I would like to see this kind of leadership across the board for everybody who leads, you know. And the leader is a part of the team, not like somebody who sits up here outside the circle and just drops down commands and or, you know, thinks of themselves more highly than they should. I mean, I think a leader should be a part of the team. It's just like a chain. And if you make a chain into a circle, each member, including the coach, everybody, is a member of that team. And if that chain is in a circle, if you break any chain, it's the same. It doesn't matter which link is more important in the circle. I mean, you just turn it. You can't tell. They're all a member of the team. And they all have their roles, though. Every member has their role. And the leader has their role. Just like on our team, the last substitute on the bench has their role. But who is to say that the leader or the last person to go into the game is more important? I see us all equally a member of the team, and we all have our role, and we're all crucial to the success of the team.
Did you come to this over a long period of time, sort of understanding this, or did it seem to come fairly naturally to you early on to see leadership and teamwork in all this way?
Well, I think the Lord blessed me with a love for people. That was the first thing. So that helped. But it is an ever-evolving thing. And it would have helped me if I had had a role model who could sit down with me and explain to me the things that they had learned through their experiences. Not that I would have to go out and do it exactly that way, but I would have a lot to think about, because as that person would talk, I would think, I'm not thinking exactly that way. And so it would give me a lot to mull over, and I might come to some different conclusions. But even at this point, after coaching 40 years, I am still learning about leadership, and it is still evolving, and I am still working on areas that are weak for me to become stronger in. I mean, there are many areas, and as you deal with so many different situations day in and day out, sometimes I disappoint myself. I wish that I had not responded in the way that I responded. It wasn't the way I wanted to, and the way that I should have. But it's still, even at this time of my life, it's like I'm not who I want to be. I'm not who I ought to be. I'm not who I'm going to be. But praise the Lord, I'm better than I used to be. You know, that's always, every day, that's true. And so I'm still learning. Communication has always been a problem for me in the area of confrontation. Mm-hmm. It's like I don't like to confront people. Mm-hmm. And I used to just not do it. I avoided doing it. But it's an area in leadership and that I had to get better at, and I knew that. And so I tried to be around people who were great communicators like that, who had a knack for it. I love people, you know, and like truth without love is brutal. I've done that before. I've been very truthful, but it was without a love. How? Because it was in the wrong setting. It was something that should have been done privately, and I did it publicly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not good. But love without truth is hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's things like this. I had to understand through making mistakes. Had, though, somebody set me down when I was young and told me about this, mm-hmm. I could have grasped it, I think, and known that that's something I never want to do. Mm-hmm. But not having a role model in that way sometimes, I made my own mistakes, and unfortunately I had to learn that way sometimes. I like it better when I can learn through other people's experiences, you know, read about it and understand it before I move into that arena, you know. But I think I love learning, and I want to keep learning to be a better and better leader. This is very important to me. Of all things, I think that a strong leader can help people to accomplish greater and better tasks. Mm-hmm. And I think leadership is the critical role. And also, I want people working for me to be a role model for them so that they can become great leaders themselves, and you pass it on. The thing is, what you learn, if you want to pass it on, you don't want to just keep it, you know, because by passing it on, you'll have a chance to have an influence for many future generations.
Let's go back for a minute to, because this is all very interesting, and then the part of the, I think the confrontation maybe ties back into some earlier experiences. Obviously, once you became the high school coach, then you become a college coach, and you're really pioneering in that field. And I'm interested in what some of the obstacles you encountered as one of these early women's coaches and how you went about trying to deal with them.
Well, when I first, there are many obstacles, so I don't even know where to begin, because, you know, when I went to Elon, was my first college coaching job, and there's no money in the budget. So, I mean, right, you know, so we had to pay our own gas and buy our own food and do whatever, buy our own shorts, T-shirts, whatever. And I remember we didn't have money, but see, the whole thing then was not to look at all that we didn't have, but to look at what we did have. I mean, we did have an opportunity to play, which just a few years earlier, the people didn't have that opportunity. So we have to focus a little on what we do have. At least we have this opportunity. So we have to be grateful for that. Not that we stop working for having more, but, and we could have a case, we could tell, sure, it's a case we should have much more because we've been all these years without anything. So we know that. But at the same time, we got to operate day to day, and you can't get everything overnight. So it's a matter of understanding that. Looking, don't forget what you do have, and then just work in the right way to get what you don't have. And I remember my players at Elon, they wanted warm up so badly. And so the track and field, I went to the track and field coach, and I talked to him about I can't remember if they were getting new warm-ups or if their season was over. Mm-hmm. But they had these warm-ups, and I asked him, they weren't using them at the time, and I asked him if we could use the warm-ups for our team. Mm-hmm. And his name was Jerry Tolley, and he agreed and gave us those warm-ups to use. Those warm-ups were for track and field, therefore being warm outside. They were heavy, and they were men's, and they were huge. And my players put them on, and they didn't ever want to take them off. They loved them. They just thought they were so special because they had warm-ups. No matter what they weighed or, you know, what they looked like, they wore them all the time. And so, you know, you look to people. You always were searching for people who were really the kind of people who liked to help other people and that you could approach, and they might in some small way do something. It might not sound that big to some people, but it was huge because when they did something, not only did they give you something, but you knew they supported you. And having that feel of support and encouragement was very important. When I came to NC State, the thing that I hated most of all was we added varsity teams, women's. And all of a sudden, we didn't add sports information people. We didn't add people in the equipment room. We didn't add in the cafeteria. We didn't add anywhere in the strength training. I mean, we didn't add personnel, but we added people that all of those people had to service and take care of and still get paid the same amount of money, but additional load. Well, I saw that right away, and I knew, I mean, that is a tough situation. I didn't make that decision, you know, but that's just the decision that had to be made at that time. And NC State was wanting to give women an opportunity to play at the varsity level, and this is the only way they could do it at that time. So I knew from the beginning that some people would have some hard feelings, because, and I understandably so. And so I was just always as cordial as I could be to everybody because I was understanding of that. And I tried not to ask for things that we really didn't need, only for things we needed at that time, until I knew that we would have to prove ourselves. I felt that many people, once they saw that we could put a quality product out there and they could see our sincerity and our genuine love and gratefulness for the opportunity, that they would, a lot of people would be willing to do extra if they needed to, because just the people they were. And so this is always the way, you know, that we had to operate, and we concentrated on putting as great a team on the floor as we could so that we could make the people here proud of the program and see, you know, how sincere we were. And we started having camps for girls at very same time, and just to see how excited young girls were to have this kind of opportunity. So I think that it paid off for us in the long run just by being considerate of other people. I mean, and understanding, sort of putting yourselves in their shoes, and yet trying to always move forward and always get more of the things that we needed to be the best that we could be.
Were there ever points where you just got fed up with that part in terms of trying to get what you could sort of by asking people rather than having all the extra resources added that you really did need?
Well, you know, it's we're still striving today in some areas. I mean, it's not something that can be solved overnight. We've come a long ways, and yet we still, you know, have a good ways to go. And money is always a problem. But, you know, you can legislate a lot of things, but you can't legislate attitude. And I find that to be the most important thing, because if you have people who have the great attitude toward women in sport, mm-hmm. often these people will find a way, mm-hmm. you know, to get things done, even if they can't do it just at the first class level. They find a way to make it happen, mm-hmm. and help you no matter what, just because they feel it's the right thing to do and it's the best thing to do. And I think that is a key more than anything else at this day and time. We still have to have Title IX in force. I mean, we could never do without that, I don't think, at this point in time in history. Maybe there come a day when we no longer need Title IX, so to speak. But we still need it now in many situations. But also, the more that we can cultivate this positive attitude toward women in sport, mm-hmm. and people just believing in that, these are the people who are, even when resources aren't there, they will find other ways to help you. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be an ongoing battle in certain areas and for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the changes? You talk about this effort to cultivate a positive attitude toward women's sport. Sort of what the attitude towards women's sport generally were when you started here at NC State, and what has changed, and maybe what has not changed about broader sort of university and community perspectives towards women in sport?
Well, when we first started, you always had people who were in favor of having women's sports program. There are always those people there. I think the difference is today there's a greater numbers of people across the university, within the community, within the Boosters Wolfpack Club. So, I mean, I think across the board there are many more people who are in favor of women in sport now. And in the beginning, there were just fewer numbers because, I mean, it was new. I mean, here are some people. I mean, Willis Casey, who hired me, was convinced this was something NC State needed to do. So, therefore, he stepped out and hired me as the first full-time woman coach in the state. So, this was because he believed it was the right thing to do. So he believed that, and there were some others who believed that. But there were other people who just thought, I mean, you know, women in sport, we don't need that. Or other people who would think, well, it's okay to have a women's team, but, we just don't need to put that much emphasis on it. I mean, you know, that's just people. But today, there are many more people who believe that women should participate in sport. Mm-hmm. I mean, they believe that they can, mm-hmm. and they can do it at a high level. They believe in the qualities and characteristics that can be developed in them through sport, just as it is in men, and that actually I think we just become better people. You know, you can be better mothers, you can be better in business, whatever you want to do, mm-hmm. you can be better as a result of it. And I even meet women in our camps who they came to our basketball camps and now their daughters come. Mm-hmm. And they often just tell me what a great experience just camp was for them, mm-hmm. you know, and what they just learned from camp. So we know if you could just learn something from going to a sports camp, you could learn a great deal from participating at a high level for 4 years. And so I think many more people see what can be developed in all people through sport now than they used to.
Do you think that there are ways in which that's particularly important for young women, given other things that young women are taught by culture and society about what they ought to do?
Well, I think, you know, in sport, to be successful, you have to be more assertive. You have to be more aggressive. You can't just be passive and just, you know, you not make decisions and just lay back and just, you know, you have to step up. You have to bring something to the table, so to speak. And you have to be a contributing member. You know, people are depending on you to contribute your talents and your abilities to the team so that we can be the best that we can be. And I would think one of the biggest qualities is about aggressiveness, you know, because how can you play the game of basketball well and at a high level and not be aggressive? But you can learn, like, there are times to be aggressive, there are times to be more aggressive, there are times to be less aggressive. And that is all within sport itself. I mean, you know, when you step off the court from practice, then, like, there's no need for, you know, the kind of aggressiveness that you needed when you were tackling that task on the court. But there, you may find in life other tasks that you need to be more aggressive, more assertive, in order to have the results and the outcome that you need and that you want. But you have learned how to be aggressive and assertive when you were playing basketball. So I think that you definitely can transfer these qualities and abilities, you know, from one area to another.
And you think those are particular qualities that are especially good for young women to learn?
I think so.
Needing to learn.
Yes, and then because for women, I do, because discipline and commitment is across the board for everybody. And guys tend to be more aggressive and more assertive, you know. And they may learn through sport to be less, you know, because you have to have self-control, you know. You absolutely have to have self-control, so it can work both ways. And you have to have respect for authority. I mean, you have officials in the game, and you have coaches. And, you know, you represent not only yourself, your family, your team, your university, your athletic department. You represent all of these things. So you learn expectations for when you represent. And so, yes, I would think aggressiveness and assertiveness just come to my mind immediately as a little different qualities than a lot of people think of women possessing.
Well, you know, over these years, you and other coaches and other universities, I mean, there's wonderful women's teams in North Carolina, women's college teams. I mean, it's really just terrific. What effect have you seen that having on girls in North Carolina, having these prominent teams and these achieving women? Do you see evidence of that having an effect on young women in North Carolina?
Well, I have to believe that it does have an effect on a number of girls in our state. I know when we go out to talk to 40 to 50 middle schools a year, that every once in a while I receive a letter from a parent who says that one of our players was at her child's school that day and that she said something to her child that just impacted her. And since we've been there, her child's doing so much better in the classroom, or her child is just has a different attitude, or so, just from players talking to them and maybe giving them a pat on the back and a word of encouragement, and it just made an impact. So if I get letters from that, I would imagine that coming to games, watching the players, getting to meet some of the players after the game, watching them on TV, I would have to believe that there are a number of girls in our state that are impacted by the college players in this state. I always try to tell our players that someone is watching everyone, you know? I mean, and somebody is watching them. There is someone watching them. And they are a role model, and they cannot get away from it. And you should just always know that, you know, there is someone watching you. And you can and will impact somebody. And you just want it to be in a positive way. So I truly believe that they are impacted. I mean, because just in our basketball camp, we have a session where, or we're doing it right now, where our players are go and they are like a panel for the campers. You know, we rotate five groups around, and they can ask our players questions, and our players tell them about themselves and about playing basketball at this level, and about when they played in high school, mm-hmm. and everything. And I think all of that has an impact. I think they look up to a lot of those players. And sometimes you look up to people and then you're disappointed mm-hmm. later because they're not who you thought they were. Or sometimes a person can just make a mistake, and hopefully people understand making a mistake, and you can just be open about it, that you just messed up. I mean, and that you know that that wasn't right, and that's a good message to send to anybody, you know. But occasionally, if you just turn out not to be, you know, it can be disappointing. And so that's why we have a responsibility to just be honest. If you do mess up, then just say it, so the people who are watching will know, and everybody messes up, so mm-hmm. people can understand that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've taken a lot of time, and I know you're busy and need to get back, but I did have a couple more questions that I wanted to ask. I think first, what do you think the major obstacles that women's basketball and women's sports faces today? What are kind of the challenges you see to overcome in terms of just the broader progress of women's sports beyond the great progress that has made to this point?
Well, to make greater progress, it also could create some difficult situations for us. But, I mean, because to make greater progress, I personally believe that it's all tied up in media. Mm-hmm. I think that's where it is. And we can continue to have the best teams that we can have. We can continue developing women players and get them to higher levels, have better coaches. I think better coaches all the way down. I still don't think we have across the board the kind of great coaches in every high school, junior high, rec leagues. I don't think every rec league has a league for young girls. Mm-hmm. So we got all of that to do. But so we just need to keep working on developing better women's players. But even now, let's say we get all that done, we still won't be there if the media doesn't, warm up to us a little more, because you know every once in a while they show a few games, and I know, and we have the greatest ACC television package we've ever had, and we were on TV a lot last year. It's just that you can't count on it year in and year out. And, you know, you start to get a good package, and then you're on ESPN, and then they move you to ESPN2. And then you move to the next ESPN station that they put on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then ESPN is just showing men sports. Mm-hmm. And media, we just like, what about, I mean, in the paper, even today, 2005, we can't get a box score for our women's games. We don't have, when you see who won ACC games and you're looking, you'd like to see how many minutes each of their players played, how they shot the ball, their percentage, you know. We don't have a box score. We just have a little line down there that might give the lead-in scores. I mean, that's a box score. Come on. I mean, that's the game. So when you see that in a paper, that tells you everything. I mean, we don't even, in their minds, deserve a box score. I mean, so when I see something like that, yes, I mean, and people, we've written in about it, and other people have written about it, and we still don't have a box score. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the media has to really embrace us in a much bigger way. And, of course, when the media does embrace us in a much bigger way, it brings on a whole new set of challenges mm-hmm. when that happens.
Such as?
Well, we become so much more visible. Mm-hmm. So many more people know what is happening mm-hmm. with basketball. So then people want to get involved in it. Mm-hmm. And then everything that's with the men's sports and men's basketball becomes our challenges. Everything. Mm-hmm. All of it.
Right. Money, recruiting,
everything. People are, because higher expectation, because of more visibility for more people, then the more temptation to get in the gray area and over for recruiting and then more need more money and more. I mean, and that's just the bad part, you know? Mm-hmm. So who knows? I don't know what's best. I don't really want to make that call. I feel my call is to put out the best team that I can possibly put out mm-hmm. and hope that people will enjoy watching their performance. Mm-hmm. And that we can share it with people, because the more people you have, I think it raises the standard of play. I mean, when the gym is packed mm-hmm. and we're playing, that's some of the best women's games. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why men play consistently at a high level. If every men's team doesn't have packed gyms, but when the house is packed, mm-hmm. people playing know a lot is expected of them. And when you know a lot's expected of you, you try to rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. And when there's few people there, I mean, you don't feel that same adrenaline flow that you feel when it's packed. Mm-hmm. And you need that to rise to your highest level, mm-hmm. you know. Actually, pressure can either help or hurt you. Mm-hmm. But that's your choice, you know. You can thrive on the pressure mm-hmm. and the challenge, and it can bring the best out in you. Mm-hmm. Or you can, you know, fear that pressure mm-hmm. and hate it and sort of choke mm-hmm. at the moment you need it the most. Mm-hmm. But a great competitor is at their best when their best is needed. Mm-hmm. And if you thrive on a challenge, you know, and you get a packed house, you're gonna play your best.
That's really interesting. I think that just says a lot. You know, there still are just so many people, and some of these media people may be among them, that just still lack respect for women's sports for whatever reason. What do you think can be done to change that, if anything?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a societal problem. Mm-hmm. It's like almost we need a psychiatrist, a sociologist. We need a social science person. We need all these people together and to answer this question for us. I really feel that way. I would like for them to tell why won't they accept, you know, women in sport. And I'm not really sure of the people who are just headstrong against women in sport. I have no idea, because everything that we have used to really justify men in sport in higher institutions of learning has been about what they will get from the experience, the qualities and characteristics that they will be developed to help them to be a success, and that they're the lifeline and sort of the heartbeat of the university. They are the school spirit is where it comes from. So why that wouldn't be for all people is an absolute mystery to me. It's just a societal, attitudinal problem, and I don't know. It will take generations to erase that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and we just simply can't, I feel, just do that much about it for those people until hopefully other generations come. And when they come into the world, this is just the way it is. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know any other way. Mm-hmm. There's too many people, I guess, still living that that know other ways. It wasn't like this. Mm-hmm. And when they
didn't grow up in Gibsonville, knowing that the girls played
right
from the start.
They didn't. There's too many people who it just doesn't seem right to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't know it that way, and change. And people have a hard time with change. Mm-hmm. You know, they cannot view change as an opportunity. They do not have that viewpoint about change. Mm-hmm. Change to them is bad. And it was good enough this way, so why are we wanting to do something different, you know? But the people who can view change as an opportunity, they're with us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm just guessing we'll have to wait a number of generations.
Mm-hmm. If you look back just at your life and think about the 7-year-old who got this basketball and where you've come and all that you've done, what thoughts come to your mind how all this happened?
Well, the first thought is that, well, I've been really blessed. And I don't understand it. I don't know how. I've never planned on coaching basketball. And I certainly never planned to leave high school and go to college. Once I got to Elon, I never planned to come to NC State. But then people talked me into applying for this position, and going. I was always happy where I was. I mean, I think happiness is, you know, it's a choice, and it's a state of the mind. Mm-hmm. And you can just decide, ahead of time that you're going to be happy. I mean, it doesn't depend on anything else but just a choice you made. And I know this because I read a story about an elderly lady who was legally blind. Mm-hmm. And her husband just passed away, and they were moving her into an assisted living home. Mm-hmm. And as they were coming into the facility, the ladies started to tell her about the decorations and, you know, how beautiful it was. And she stopped them and she said, "You don't need to tell me about it. I have already decided that it was beautiful." She said, "I know that it's beautiful. I decided that mm-hmm. before I came." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, to me, that is a really neat statement to know, you know, that, I mean, that's the way I felt. I was happy where I was, you know, I knew. And I could be happy anywhere that I went. But since I was happy where I was, why would I move? But people taught me into it. Mm-hmm. And every place, I think, you know, when I came to NC State, along the way, there were calls from people about, you know, other jobs. But what they never knew is I'm not a person that would really move. I wouldn't have moved from high school if there hadn't have been a person who just wouldn't let go of the idea of me applying at Elon College. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have left Elon College if there hadn't been a person who just wouldn't let go of my applying to NC State. Mm-hmm. If anybody perhaps had come along who wouldn't let go, but they didn't know that, you know, about me. You know, I mean, and because I always knew every place I was, I liked it, but I had already decided I knew I would like it, because it was like my mom was like, I'm looking for the positives. I'm looking, you know, for everything I really like about it. I'm not really looking for the things I don't like about it. I'm not magnifying those things. I'm not focusing on them, you know. So it's very interesting. But I was just always happy where I was.
One other thing that happened, obviously, some years ago, you're known throughout the state as a basketball coach and throughout the world, obviously, as a basketball coach, the Olympics and all the other things you've done. And then you become very well known for having breast cancer. Could you talk about that a little bit in terms of leadership and being in the public eye on that?
Well, I felt like it was really important for me to step forth and to really say what was going on in my life. In August of 87, when my breast cancer was first diagnosed, you know, there was a debate with the sports information department as to what we should release. And I was still at that time planning to be the Olympic coach the following year. I mean, it was actually just maybe 10 months away that we would start training and, you know, selecting the team. And I felt that it's very important that we come out with the details and the truth, because at some point I would be in a press conference and they would pursue everything further if we were vague. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like just say that I, you know, have breast cancer and had a mastectomy, and just tell let the doctor, you know, talk about it. These are the decisions that were made and this is what's happening. And at that time, people weren't talking about breast cancer as much. And, you know, I think some people felt uncomfortable, like, but I really insisted on this. And so we did the release. And the most interesting thing is, because we did the release and it went on the AP wire across the country, from that point on, I received so many letters from churches, from Sunday school classes, from individuals, from Bible study groups, people praying for me. Mm-hmm. And that was a result of releasing the truth about it, you know? And that, it could have never happened if we had just been vague about what the hospitalization was all about. Mm-hmm. And so with specific people knew how to pray, mm-hmm. you know. And so I was really blessed by all those prayers and everything. Mm-hmm. And then I had opportunity from that point on to speak to many groups about breast cancer, because I was open about it and I just shared my experience with all kinds of groups. some support groups for other women. People would call me or write me, ask me to call this person, write this person. I would do that. October Breast Cancer, National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Many people want me to speak to this group, speak to that group. We started Race for the Cure in Raleigh. Wanted me to be honorary chair for the first 3 years. American Cancer Society, just over and over and over. I have been honorary chair, and I have spoken and have done time after time after time. And I have received letter after letter after letter of people who have thanked me for just speaking out and how much it has helped them. They say I've encouraged and motivated them in their own battle. You know, just from speeches I've given or from interviews that I've had or whatever. So, and then this past November 2004, I had a diagnosis of a reoccurrence of breast cancer. And now the same thing, people call, people write. I meet people on the street. I just met someone yesterday who stopped me and she just wanted to thank me for being a role model. She's had breast cancer. It's been about a year, and she's just like, you know, she's open with it. She's fighting it. Just, she says, because I inspired her to do it. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel good, and I'm really glad, because I know that people who stay positive and people who do what they can do, and they just stay strong and courageous, they have their best shot. And if I could help people to have that kind of mindset and that kind of attitude and to go on with their life, and I think they have the best chance. And so I'm really glad to be a part of that. And I'll just continue to speak, you know, at places about it, to be a part of races that raise money for cancer research, the Jimmy V Foundation. I've served on the board of directors. I played in every golf tournament that they've had. And I just continue to be out there, you know, as far as breast cancer is concerned.
Sounds like, in a way, it's not that different from being a coach, sort of what you try to accomplish with talking about it.
Well, I know this, that so many of the qualities and characteristics that it takes in sport are very valuable in the fight against cancer. Even though my faith is always, whether I'm a coach or whether I'm fighting cancer, my faith is at the forefront. I mean, you know, I'm first just leaning and trusting on God. But He has given me a competitive, spirit and determination. And I realize this is the toughest foe I'm facing. I mean, my arch rivals in basketball are tough, but they don't really hold a candle to the foe of cancer. And fighting that foe is the toughest battle that I have. And I know that determination, that commitment to a lifestyle change, you know, what I'm eating and how I need to exercise and everything. I know all of those things kick in. And I have to have the discipline and the self-control to do it. And I understand that from sport very well. And so it's a pleasure of mine if I could help anybody else understand it. Many who haven't been in sport and might not have used these qualities and characteristics to the extent that people in sport might have been called on to use them. They have them within them. And a lot of them they have used in raising their own families and on. They just need to realize, just let it kick in for cancer. And so that's what I try to do.
Yeah. Well, this has just been terrific. I appreciate it so much. Is there anything else that you think is important about, I mean, I'm sure many things, but just anything that comes in mind that seems important to say, this point about your career or leadership or just anything that...
No, I mean, I just think of things like for people who might lead, let me think about how I want to say this. It's something like it's not crowded on the extra mile. I mean, the people who are willing to go the extra mile, that's not a road traveled as much. And it's not crowded there. And I think people who are going to lead really have to get on that road. And nothing will ever replace, like, hard work, the, you know, industriousness. And it's more than the willingness. Willingness sort of has a connotation of, okay, I'll do it. I mean, I'm going to do it, but maybe your heart's not in it. Fully, you know, but you're willing to do it. But eagerness, on the other hand, connotates your heart is in it. And I think that eagerness to work hard and that, you know, that really changes everything. Because I know all along the way I had friends who always used to say to me early on, which they don't say it anymore, but they used to say early on, why do you work so much? Why? I mean, you need to take a break. And I could never fully get through to them that what I'm doing is not work. You know, I love what I'm doing. That I enjoy it. I want to do it. It's not like they see me as spending this extra time and all, but I love it, and it's not work. And so if you love what you're doing, I mean, you're going to be so much better at it because it's never going to seem like work. And yet, you do have to have balance. Balance is a key word. You know, you have to know set priorities, and you really have to know. I mean, like for me, like sometimes I get off track, but I know that faith, family, and friends are my priorities. And when I find I have no time for those things, I'm out of whack. And I have to get back and get balance there. And I think it's important that people get their priorities set and that they know when they get out of balance and they get back into balance. Even if though I love what I'm doing, there is a limit here. If it runs over and really affects those three things that are my priorities, then it's not good no matter what. And I would just encourage everybody to you know, get their priorities straight. And also to know service is so important. Giving back, because I think people think all the time of having to overcome adversity, and that the ability to overcome adversity is critical in being successful and being a leader. I mean, you have to have the ability to overcome that. But there's the other end, that you have to also be able to handle success. If you don't handle success well, then you may find that you don't keep having success. And I think in having success, people don't, they know they got to overcome maybe adversity, but I'm not sure they always understand that there's the opposite end, that they have to deal with that end just as well as the other end. And I think you have to remember, you know, your roots at the other end. I mean, success, you can rejoice and enjoy. For the moment, it's awesome. And then you have to remember your roots.
How do you do that? How do you remember?
All right, well, I'll tell you. You remember your roots. And then I want to just tell you that after you remember your roots, you really need to reach out and help other people. I mean, that, and then if you get in this cycle, then you have a chance to continue success, I think. Without that cycle, I think your teetering, I think it won't stay there as long. You remember your roots well, because there's been so many people that helped you along the way. And all of a sudden, if you just start thinking that you're doing it, and I mean, that's a dangerous mindset, because nobody does something great without somebody else. I mean, what does one person do that's great? I mean, I don't think that it happens. I think you have people along the way. They have. I used to say in some speeches that they dug wells, and we drank from those wells. Mm-hmm. And they built fires, and we were warm by those fires. And now, after you have success, you have to dig wells that others might drink from and build fires that others might be warmed by. I mean, it's a responsibility. And service, I once read a thing that said the first third of your life is about wait a minute. Can we stop just a minute? Let me think this, because this I would like to share.
Okay.
Okay. I got it. Be sure I had it in my mind. Okay. I once read something that said, the first third of your life is about learning. The second third is about earning. And the third part is about returning. And I sort of think there's a lot of truth in that. Though I think learning is a lifetime process, so you never stop. But perhaps the main focus early is learning. Mm-hmm. And then you have that period of your life, the main focus is earning. Mm-hmm. And then at the last, the main focus is returning or serving. Though all along the way, you should want to serve, you know. And all along the way, you should want to learn. I mean, I do think that a primary focus, it's the times of our lives that, for instance, when people retire, they have all that time that they could return, they could serve and volunteer and help others in a big way, where you've been helping in smaller ways all along the way. But I think there's a lot of truth to that. And that all of that is tied in with success and at the other end, and something that we should never forget.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Lots of things come to my mind, but